I'm your host, Jeff Ragavan, and welcome to Alchemy, the podcast all about building a business on the front lines of the new economy.
Welcome back to this week's episode of Alchemy. Very excited to welcome Joe Spector. He's the founder and CEO of Dutch. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. For everybody who's listening in right now, Dutch is a very interesting company. They're really built on the power of telehealth, except something different. Dutch really helps pet parents get to the root of their pets' conditions by making vet visits convenient and accessible. And I feel like we've done this now for years, telehealth for humans, and now you're doing it for pets, which is really very cool. And Joe, I've been very excited to talk to you. You know, you have an amazing career. You're a great entrepreneur. You know, you were also the former co-founder at Him and Hers, which, by the way, I'm a customer. So thank you for making all those products very easy to get.
Yes.
And so excited to talk to you today. I think it might be fun just to kick off the show and, you know, talk to us a little bit about your journey, you know, as an entrepreneur. And I read some very interesting things about you, and I don't want to steal your thunder, but, you know, take us through even your early days and where you are today.
Yeah. So, you know, I was originally born not in the United States. I was born in the former Soviet Union in what's now Uzbekistan. So when I came here when I was 10 years old, and it was a lot more of survival and just making sure there's food on the table. So entrepreneurship wasn't necessarily top of mind. It wasn't really until business school when I really started to discover my comrades and really start to feel comfortable to take that plunge, because it is a plunge. It, especially if you didn't grow up around it, like myself, it can feel very unnerving. But I think that for, you know, given my life, I was fairly comfortable with risk. In fact, I probably sought it out. And I also think, given just my personality of wanting to be creative, wanting to rebel against authority, I think I had sort of the natural characters of a entrepreneur.
One of the things that I was reading that was so interesting is that you fled Uzbekistan. And one of the things that I read is that entrepreneurship could be actually considered a crime. Is that true?
Yeah. There are so many things, you know, like having that perspective that we just take things, so many things for granted in the United States. But in communism, everything is owned by the state. And so doing anything entrepreneurial was considered illegal. Mm-hmm. If you look at Russia, even today, being an entrepreneur comes with a social contract that you don't do anything political. Mm-hmm. But before that, it was my grandfather had his own business, a small business that he was running out of his house. And my mom remembers standing, and this is her as a child, standing outside and looking out for any potential like unknown or suspicious cars that might be going down the street, so she could quickly run in and tell him to wrap it. You know, it was almost like a speakeasy where she, you know, she'd run in and tell him to quickly shut everything down and shuffle clients into a closet. And all he was doing was being a dentist, by the way.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy. And so you came over to the U.S. and obviously then started to build your entrepreneurial roots, right? Which is pretty amazing. Let's talk about Hims and Hers for a quick second before we get into Dutch. Mm-hmm. I think this is also a really interesting moment, I think, in, you know, medical history as well, because you have so many people who, you know, have either things that are not life-threatening, but then also, you know, things that people might be embarrassed about to talk to their doctor. And you guys come up with, you know, this amazing, you know, business where people can essentially, you know, talk to, you know, a doctor as part of, you know, the medical network that you guys built, you know, through the site. And you guys eventually went public at what? Probably, I think it was something like 1.6 billion valuation at the time.
Yep. Yep.
So where did, I know you had a bunch of co-founders, like where did the idea come from? Like, how did you guys meet?
It's almost, in many ways, I think it's a classic Silicon Valley story and a classic entrepreneurial story, in that it took for me 10 years of failures before this overnight success happened. Mm-hmm. And it took 10 years of me being in Silicon Valley, developing relationships that ultimately led to this. So I've worked at over a dozen startups, and I've met so many, you know, wonderful people along the way. And that led me to Atomic Studios, which still is an incubator of startups. And one of the main founding partners there, Jack Abraham, would say, you know, I have, I think he'd say he has like 500 different ideas. And, but with startups, as people find out, it's, you know, idea is just 1% and 99% is execution. So he has lots of ideas, and this was an idea among those hundreds that was being talked about. Mm-hmm. With the Atomic partners. And it had been something that, like I said, I mean, they have, you know, all kinds of ideas that are just in the ether. And, but when I met them, I just thought they were incredibly smart, incredibly connected, which is also really important. And it felt like a place that I just wanted to be a part of without even knowing more than that. And they actually told me to go away multiple times. And just because, you know, they're focused on the startups that were already up and running, and many of those startups had their own problems that they were busy fixing. And kind of the message for me was, you seem like, you know, a great, smart, driven guy, but we don't have anything for you right now. So let's just stay in touch. And for me, my thing is, once I'm zoned in on something, mm-hmm. I don't take no for an answer.
I love it. I mean, that's the thing. You've got to, it being an entrepreneur, right? Because you get a lot of doors getting closed in front of you, and you know this in the fundraising process. Like, everybody, you got to have thick skin. You got to be able to, like, keep going on and you know, persevere. And I think that's not a trait that everybody has, right? Some people be like, you know what, fuck this, I'm out, yeah. Right? Yeah. And they give up. So yeah. you gotta be persistent. Yeah. Oh, that's a great story.
Yeah.
I would imagine, Joe, you probably, you know, had a lot of learnings, you know, from, you know, building Hims and, you know, building out that, you know, company and platform, and, you know, really taking what you learned from there into your new startup, you know, with Dutch. And I think that's, you know, there's obviously something very similar there as far as the telehealth platforms, right? Mm-hmm. Talk to us a little bit about, you know, the launch with Dutch and how you guys are doing, and how are consumers reacting to being able to talk to someone in real time?
Yeah. As far as lessons learned, you know, what's been interesting about that is there are many lessons learned that apply to Dutch, and there's lessons learned that I thought applied to Dutch that I, realize don't. Mm-hmm. But I think one of the main lessons from Hims that I did take into Dutch is work on the hard things. And the hard things are, you know, that's where you really solve consumers' problems. And don't work on gimmicks. And I think especially in direct-to-consumer, there's lots of gimmicks, such as kind of pretty packaging or, you know, dressed up websites. And those are nice. But if you're solving a real difficult problem, that's when consumers are going to pay for it, stick around, and talk about, you know, talk about the business and spread it word of mouth. So don't be afraid and spend the time working on the thing that's hard. Mm-hmm. And for him, the thing that's hard was what we were talking about, the medical part. And that goes the same for Dutch. Prior to Dutch, there had been lots of businesses that would give advice or, you know, just the overall pet industry, you know, the explosion has really been around food and toys, all this stuff that's like peripheral. But the fact is that millions of animals get zero care because the friction of going to a veterinarian, the cost of going to a veterinarian prevents tens of millions of pets from getting any care whatsoever.
I've got pets, I have dogs, and you know, I dread going to the vet, you know, one, because it's not fun, and two, because it's expensive. And I think a lot of people, I wonder too, with a lot of people who have dogs, I'm like, you know, vet bills can be super expensive, even with insurance, you know? But it is an interesting industry, right? You're talking about, you know, over $100 billion, you know, in the pet industry right now between, you know, new business, brands, foods, all that stuff. So you're definitely, you definitely found a very interesting market, you know, to fill right now.
Yeah.
Are you seeing any like disruptions in that space? Like, have there been other people that have said, hey, we're going to do this too, looking at what you guys have done?
They have started to be. I think there is. So in the veterinary world, it is way behind the human world as far as adoption of telemedicine and frankly, other technology. And they, even during COVID, I think didn't really catch up as much as telemedicine on the human side advanced forward. And so there's still, I mean, it's a very kind of pencil and paper industry still. And any sort of change is creating fears and concerns about bad actors and malpractice. And this is in many ways things I saw at HIMSS, so I'm not a bit surprised, but there are very few companies that are, and Dutch is by far tip of the spear as far as in how many, because healthcare law is governed at the state level and different states have different laws. Mm-hmm. So my legal experience and operational experience from HIMSS has allowed me to have the lawyers and counsel and lobbyists to help us move much further than anybody else. But it's certainly that overall attitude that there's no way you can prescribe something or give a treatment plan to a dog unless you touch and feel the, you know, the body. That kind of thinking has prevented pretty much anybody else from entering the fray to the extent that Dutch has. And I think something that people really forget, but it's incredible, both veterinarians as well as venture capitalists, which is there are millions of people who make, you know, less than $75,000 a year. Like I can't afford vet bills, but someone making like $60,000 really can't afford it.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, and we see almost half of our clients haven't, their pets haven't seen a vet in 3 years or more.
Wow, that's crazy.
So telemedicine, you know, talk about opening up access. We see that in spades. And we see that really for people who, like I said, don't have that much money to pay for a vet in the first place. Forget the convenience of it all. And also forget the fact that, by the way, there's not even enough veterinarians for the people who are seeing a vet, because it can easily take several weeks just to get an appointment And telemedicine would do wonders to add Slack into the system, but it's certainly something that can open doors for people who've never seen a vet to begin with.
Now, from a, you know, getting the word out there and getting people to, you know, utilize Dutch, how are you guys activating consumers? Like, how are you making them aware of your product?
Yep. A couple things. Certainly, very often, consumers are coming to Dutch because their pet is experiencing an issue. And so they're often finding us through Google, and that could be paid. We have also invested heavily in search engine optimization, mm-hmm. writing lots of relevant content. And that was a strategy that we did at Hims as well that paid off.
Yeah.
We're also working with shelters. There are thousands of shelters across the United States, and we can provide the people who adopt there an initial month of Dutch service for free. So we're partnering with shelters a lot to spread the word.
Joe, quick question for you, and it just popped in my head. For the name, is Dutch the name of your dog? Like, tell us about the name.
The name is a funny story. It was supposed to be the name of our dog, but to walk it back further, kind of the seed for it for the business happened because my wife and I were holed up during COVID, like everybody else.
Yeah.
And we were binge watching the last season of the Netflix show, The Crown.
Mm-hmm.
And in The Crown, this is so silly, but it was focused on Princess Diana, and her nickname was Dutch.
Huh.
And so that's how the idea, and just the name came into my head. And by the way, and then we got a corgi, just like the royal dog.
Yes.
But what I loved about the name later, as we were brainstorming other names, is that one kind of a mistake we made with Hims is that we put ourselves into a corner by making it gender specific. And so we had to create the Hers brand name.
Right. By the way, I was wondering about that because like Hers came later.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Taking that into account, I wanted a name that can be, you know, can grow into other verticals and not be cornered.
Yeah.
I also wanted a name that you couldn't spell incorrectly. And Hims, by the way, in the early days when it wasn't as known, people spelled it as a church hymn, H-Y-M.
Yeah.
So I wanted a name that you couldn't spell incorrectly. And then I really liked how Dutch has a single syllable, hard, you know, beginning and ending. So it sounds very authoritative because with healthcare, you want to demonstrate that authority and trust. So the idea came from The Crown, but it had a lot of other branding qualities that I loved, taking lessons learned from Hims.
I always love hearing about how people come up with their names. I assumed it was your dog. So really cool stuff, and you know, excited for you. And you've been doing this now for a couple of years. So, you know, I every single show that we do, we always kind of talk about work in the beginning, but we kind of end it with some fun quick fire questions. And so I have a really great question for you, very relevant to what you're working on with the Dutch. So here's your first question, Joe. Are you ready?
Yes, I'm dying.
If you could switch lives with your pet for a day, what do you think they would do?
With the pet?
Yeah, so if your corgi could switch, like, go into your body.
Oh, and the corgi was me?
Yeah, like what would he or she do?
Just live the most lavish boss life.
It's kind of a funny question, right? Like, you know, I'm even thinking about my dog. Like, if my dog were to switch into my body for a day, I think he would just do what he normally does, right? Which is like sleep.
Sleep, yeah.
I mean, I'm looking at him right now. He's sitting on the chair in my office.
Sleep, bark, eat.
Exactly. Okay, so this is another really good question that I think is very focused on you, especially with your, you know, kind of career and, you know, coming to the U.S. But if you could go back in time and give your younger self one piece of advice, what would it be?
One of the main things I've learned as I've gotten older is to be comfortable with who you are and who I am. And I've had so many, you know, like in the beginning, it was, and I had this for a while where people would say, I'm too soft-spoken, I'm not salesman-y enough. And, you know, so as a result, how could you fundraise? How could you do PR? How could you do any of these things when you're so, you know, not the caricature of what I thought X was, what an entrepreneur is. And I think the more, as I've gotten older, clearly whatever I have is working, and it's just being comfortable in my own skin and realizing I don't have to be this other caricature. I just need to lean into my strengths.
Good answer. Okay, last question. So, you know, something that you've really wanted to try, but have been afraid to. Anything that you could think of, like, could be skydiving, could be a trip, could be, you know, just something that you really have wanted to do your whole life, but you haven't done it yet because of one reason or another.
This, the one thing that comes to mind is my kids have challenged me to eat puffer fish.
Oh.
Which could be deadly. But it sounds really tempting to try.
Well, puffer fish as far as sushi or puffer fish just in general?
As sushi, as raw.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, but they know what they're doing now. Like, they know the, you know, the poisonous avoid. You're good, Joe. okay, well, I think, you know, you're in LA, right? Or no, you're in San Francisco.
Yeah, San Francisco.
Okay, you've got like the best sushi places there.
Okay, so you would trust it.
Totally.
Okay.
I don't think I've heard like stories in a very long time of anybody dying from that.
So hopefully I wouldn't be the first.
Joe, do some research, right? See like people dying from, you know, the toxin from pufferfish.
Okay.
Or blowfish, but I think you're good. I've actually never tried it. The one that you have in the sushi restaurant. I've only had like, you know, fried puffers. I live out in the Hamptons. And so in the summer, it's like a big thing out here. In the beginning of the season, everyone gets these fried puffer fish, and it kind of tastes like chicken. But I might want to do that too, now that you're bringing it up, because I've never actually seen it on a menu before, the blowfish. And I eat a lot of sushi.
I think it has bad branding.
I think it's, you know, it's either rare or I don't know. I haven't heard too many people trying it. So this is going to be good for both of us.
Okay.
Awesome. Well, Joe, listen, it's great to have you on the show. You know, congrats on all of your success. And, you know, obviously we'll be keeping an eye on Dutch and, you know, wishing you the best of luck there.
Thank you so much. This was fun.
Totally.
This episode of the Alchemy Podcast was brought to you by Philo. Thanks for tuning in. And if you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and share.